On the Job with Frances Leach and Sally Rugg.
It's On the Job, the podcast all about making your working life better. Frances Leach here.
And Sally Rugg here. How are you going, Frances?
I'm okay, mate. How are you?
Yep, I'm good. Surviving the freezing cold Melbourne winter, but I'm feeling really good. I think there's a lot of things to be positive about at the moment.
There is. It feels like it's a different energy in the air, and I don't know whether that's mostly perception rather than reality because we've lived under a Liberal government for so very long that was probably antithetical to everything we believed in and was hoping for our community and our friends and families, but it does feel a little bit different. Are we kidding ourselves or should we just embrace it?
If we are kidding ourselves and if it is just perception and not reality, I'd like a couple more days with it. Like, that's fine for the moment. I think there would be a lot of people being like, oh, we'll just hang here for a minute and sort of catch our breath and recover. So, don't tell me if it's perception or reality just yet.
Yeah, right. We've just voted we're going to go with the flow and go with the energy. Fair enough. Okay. But one of the things that does happen is sort of, even though we're percolating in this feel-good factor, is the Liberal Party does elect a new leader, tries a reset, tries to rebrand, you know, the usual hoary cliches rolled out about learning and listening to the electorate, blah, 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 blah. And we get Peter Dutton, and he stands up on his very first press conference and he utters the words, the forgotten people. And my ears go, bing, I've heard that one before from Liberal politicians.
The forgotten people. Yeah, it's a real, it's almost like one of those political phrases like fair dinkum. Like, I've never heard someone who isn't a politician use the phrase fair dinkum. And I don't know if I've heard the phrase forgotten people outside of politics, unless it's like some sort of, I don't know, like sci-fi fantasy. I've never really heard the forgotten people. But yeah, I'm interested to know where it comes from.
Yeah, well, I thought that might be a good deep dive into the history of Australian politics today, an opportunity to do that with our favourite, Dr. Liam Byrne, Labor historian at the Australian Council of Trade Unions. He knows his stuff, and I'm sure he knows where the forgotten people comes from. Hey, Liam, welcome back to the pod.
G'day, g'day, comrades. Wonderful to be here. I don't know why he's complaining about this weather. My family are all Scottish, so, you know, this rain, this drizzle seems very natural to me. It seems, well, go down to the beach in this weather, so.
Right at home, absolutely. Hey, Liam, we were just talking before about how when we heard the forgotten people, we went, ooh, I've heard that one before. Was that the same for you?
It was. It's definitely one of those things as a historian that makes your ear prick up. It's also not the first time. Peter Dutton's used it in his early speeches as part of his parliamentary career. And it is important to point out, though, that the term that he actually used, so he's used a few different terms, but he actually used was forgotten Australians in this speech. And the reason why I think that's important to point out is that, firstly, it's a bit of a mishmash of a couple of different things. So quiet Australians and forgotten people, and it's a bringing of these sort of things together. But also, this is not the first time the term forgotten Australians has been used. It was used by the Australian Senate as part of its report into children who were abused in institutional care in 2003, I believe it was. I'd have to double check that date, but in the early part of this century. So, you know, for that term to be used, it's not the first time. And I think that there's, you know, resonances there that need to be identified. But the idea of the forgotten people, or as Dutton said, the people in the suburbs and across regional Australia, the small businesses whose lot the Labor Party will make more difficult, as he said in his speech, this is certainly not the first time that term has been used in Liberal Party politics in this country.
I suspect that Peter Dutton isn't making reference to that 2003 or thereabouts report into children who were abused in care. Like, that, just something about Mr. Dutton makes me think that that's not really his jam. What do you think, Dr. Liam?
The forgotten people and sort of this idea, as I said, I think that it's a bit of a mishmash. And he did use the term forgotten people as well in his maiden speech to Parliament. And so I brought a little present for you, which was his Peter Dutton's maiden speech to Parliament.
Oh, wow.
No, thanks.
There's just one little bit that I had to read out to you, and I apologise for this, but I just had to. Where so Peter Dutton said, and this is for anybody who wants to fact check me, it's available on his website. Feel free to go grab it from there. I'm sure everybody who's listening regularly checks Peter Dutton's website. But he says, the fight for a better place in which to live today is made even more difficult for many reasons, not the least of which is the fact that the boisterous minority and the politically correct seem to have a disproportionate say in the public debate. The silent majority, the forgotten people, or the aspirational voter of our generation, as some like to term them, are fed up with bodies like the Civil Liberties Council, the Refugee Action Collective, and wait for it, this is a direct quote, and certainly the dictatorship of the trade union movement.
Wow.
So a very moderate, welcoming, lovable sort of presentation of Peter Dutton's politics there. But this is the term "the forgotten people" is something which is deeply, deeply invested in Liberal Party history in this country. And it derives predominantly from Robert Menzies.
So when did Menzies first use the idea of the forgotten people?
So Robert Menzies, people may be aware, was Australia's Prime Minister from 1939 to 1941. That was before the Liberal Party was founded. So he was part of what was called the United Australia Party. And I very clearly have to say this, no relation to the Clive Palmer United Australia Party.
However, did you see, Francis and Dr. Liam, that during the most recent election campaign, the current iteration of the United Australia Party, which is the party bankrolled by Clive Palmer, formerly the Palmer United Party. So Craig Kelly, who ran for the UAP, and Clive Palmer himself were claiming Menzies, you know, like as if, you know, Menzies came from the UAP, even though Menzies would, I suspect, not claim Craig Kelly and Clive Palmer. They were very deliberate about claiming him.
Grave robbers, that's what they are. Shameless.
That's right. But this is, it shows why the symbolism of this matters, is that it is something which is really, really, I mean, Sir Robert Menzies has a particularly unique part in Australian political history. So he was our Prime Minister from 1939 to 1941 as part of the United Australia Party. And that's only important to point out that there were many different anti-Labor conservative parties before the Liberals. And they often didn't last too long because they found it really, really hard to kind of cohere and to have a coherent program. Now, Menzies was Prime Minister. He was basically a disaster during the war, and he resigned partially because the people who he worked with, his own parliamentary colleagues, disliked him so much and wouldn't work with him.
He spent so much time in London anyway.
Months and months in London during the war. So he was out, then it was replaced by Arthur Fadden and then by John Curtin, who led the Labor administration, which successfully led both the war effort but also the post-war reconstruction. So basically the creation of the Australian welfare state after the war. Now, that background's just important because in 1942, Menzies was giving a series of lectures to the ABC radio, so to deliver these sort of like radio programs. And one of them was on the concept of the forgotten people. And this was the idea where he referred to explicitly when he was talking about the forgotten people, was the term he used was the middle class. So he was trying to refer to people. And again, as I bring my little historical treats for everyone.
We love them.
He excludes on the one hand, the rich and the powerful, which is deeply, deeply ironic. And he also excludes on the other hand, what he referred to as the mass of unskilled people and almost invariably well-organized and with their wages and conditions safeguarded by popular law. That's us, unions, so we're excluded. And he was referring to what he referred to as the salary earners, shopkeepers, skilled artisans, professional men and women, farmers, and so on. They are envied by those whose benefits are largely obtained by taxing them. So he was saying that there's a group of people out there who are, his term, the middle class, people who weren't sort of represented. And he was saying that these are the forgotten people of the time who need to be made sure that their sort of voices are being heard in politics. Now, of course, that didn't go down like super well immediately because maybe where Menzies wasn't Prime Minister again until 1949. So it's one of those Liberal Party kind of mythologies that Menzies gave the speech and it redefined politics in the era and so on and so on. That's not quite the case, but it does reveal a lot about the philosophy that he presented to the electorate during his later prime ministership. And that's why it's become so important to the Liberal Party, which was founded just a couple of years later from 1944 to 1945.
So that philosophy was what drove him to electoral success in the 50s and beyond. But the union movement remained strong and there was a wages and conditions for workers continued to improve. So how did they sit alongside each other, these two competitions of ideas? Or did the idea of the forgotten people recede into the background as Menzies took power?
Well, it's one of those things that, again, people sometimes take politicians' words in history and just take them as literal truth, which is really weird because we wouldn't do that to what politicians say today. So there's some people who sort of, particularly those who have much historical training, but who indulge in this era, who just sort of say like, oh, and this proves that Menzies was, you know, really looking out for the little guy and these sort of forgotten people. But it's important to note that what we're talking about here in terms of the forgotten people who he was thinking about was that this was a grouping of people who were of relative privilege in Australian society. It's important to point out that for Menzies, he was somebody who today his politics are completely alien to our own. He was an imperial loyalist. He supported the White Australia policy. He very much supported social ease. I mean, there's part of his speech where he explicitly talks about how wonderful it is that the middle class are the ones who fuel the lamp of learning and education in this country and talks about universities. Well, that's important because at that time, who got to go to universities? Like most working people were completely unable to do so. So his veneration of this social group was a veneration of a relatively privileged section of Australian society. Now, the thing to point out is that, of course, the Liberal Party has, from its foundation, like all political parties, has always gotten its vote from multiple sectors in society. But what this was about was cohering a social constituency who was very, very uncomfortable with the changes at the time. And what were the changes at the time? Predominantly was one of the greatest equalizations, not perfect, but one of the greatest equalizations of wealth in Australian history. And prosperity being shared, not equally, it must be said, but far more equally than it previously had been. And there were sections of society who were deeply, deeply discomforted by this and who did not like this, and they wanted change. And so Menzies was able to cohere a certain social constituency by appealing to that, appealing to the big business, which apparently he despised, and should be said, sections of the working class, which is there's always sections of the working class who have voted for the Conservatives for various different reasons. But as you quite rightly point out, this is also the time where the union movement had our peak density. So it's one of the kind of things of the time is it's easy to look back and say, oh, you know, there was so much greater equality under Menzies and distribution of prosperity. And some of that's true. But one of the major reasons why was because the union movement was there helping that distribution happen. And Menzies did not like the union movement, by the way, even though he sort of like sometimes would say positive things about unions, he did instill a number of highly political attacks on the union movement, which is attempting to take away, particularly the more militant sections of it. So, you know, it was not as though that they were just working in peaceful cooperation, but they were working within a consensus that had largely been set by the Curtin and Chifley government. It was so widely endorsed by the electorate that they couldn't shift from it.
Like an uneasy peace between them, except it sounds like it wasn't so peaceful.
Well, that's right. This is actually an international phenomenon at the time as well, is that if you look around countries like the United States of America, the United Kingdom and Australia, so obviously all playing relatively equivalent roles in the war in their own sort of specific regions, was in each of these countries, you have a compact which is sort of created at this time. So remember, right before the Second World War was the Great Depression. So the Great Depression is international capitalism just going berserk and working people paying for a crisis that their big business and bankers have created and clearly created. So the system was massively discredited, you know, the free market system. And then during the war, it was so clear that the state, the government had a positive role to play, firstly, in prosecuting the war that the market could not do, and secondly, in building prosperity after the war. Like that was the government clearly had a role to play. So it was impossible to have this sort of argument on a mainstream basis that the government is the cause of ill, you know, all the things we associate with neoliberalism now. This was basically the preserve of people who had no role in the public debate whatsoever. And it was only over the process of decades that those, what we would today call neoliberals, the people who wanted to attack the role of government, were gradually able to assert themselves. So people like Menzies, of course, you know, coming from that sort of context, like you would have to be an incredibly inept politician to come out swinging against the role of government. And I think this also demonstrates a little bit that he is quite distinct from contemporary liberals, because while his worldview is quite abhorrent to me and quite distasteful, and a lot of aspects of it I think would just be completely rejected, I do think that he was somebody who did conceive himself as standing and using government for public good, how he understood it. Now, I don't understand it the same way. But how many liberals today would we genuinely say go into government with a sense of, you know, of absolute service and wanting to use government for good? I mean, how many do we hear them getting up there in their parliamentary maiden speeches are all about how government is evil?
Well, you just read us one from Peter Dutton, who's just lined up his enemies against the wall in his maiden speech and ready, aim, fire. It's fascinating, though, because it is like a trope like battlers that continues to be an allure to politicians and to the media class as well. It always comes up. And we saw it in 1996 with Howard's battlers, whatever that was. And then again, Morrison tried to reboot it with the Quiet Australians. So what are the through lines there? So Howard's battlers, how do they relate to the depiction of this middle class that Menzies talked about, this so-called middle class of shopkeepers that Menzies talked? This was a different iteration of that, but was trying to pull the same lever about a class of people who were underrepresented, who'd been silenced by the political fashions of the times and needed a voice.
Well, again, just like I apologize for quoting at you, but
quite away.
Here's a couple of things from the Menzies speech. So he refers to the middle class and he says, as I read before, they are envied by those whose benefits are largely obtained by taxing them. He also says,
wow,
and tell me
what a burn.
Tell me if this sounds familiar to you, to make them not leaners, but lifters.
We've heard that before, Sally.
We have. I didn't know that Joe Hockey was plagiarizing that sentiment back in 2014. I'm shocked to hear it.
But if you look at it the long scale, the threads of continuity is that in the early 20th century, the labor movement arose in a very powerful new form in Australia. And it was basically making the argument that, you know, working people were being taken advantage of by big business and by other sections of society, and that we had a right to political representation and to greater economic gains. That was the argument. So, you know, if you look at the iconography of the time, you often see like proud working people, you know, and so on. Over a period of time, the Conservatives created their own sort of version of this, which was attempt to discredit the Labor argument and to present themselves as representing the people who truly had the moral fibre of the nation, which is what Menzies was talking about, who truly contributed, who truly built it, the lifters, not the leaners. And that allegation, again, of whose benefits are largely obtained by taxing them. And this idea that the people who are out there showing the initiative, they were entrepreneurs, creating the small businesses and so on, that these were the people who were actually being ripped off. And effectively what it meant, and they didn't say this explicitly, every time workers get a wage rise, they're ripping off those people. That's the effective argument. Every time there's a social benefit, they're ripping off those people. That's the effective argument. And it's just something that we see conservatives do constantly and right-wingers do constantly, is they try and play off different sectors of society, which probably have greater sort of interest in connecting than they do in diverting. So you look at small business today. I mean, the simple reality is if you're a small business right now, I would be deeply, deeply concerned about wage cuts, because who's going to come through the door with money to spend in your business? So actually working people in small business do have this sort of like connection, but that doesn't really help the conservatives in terms of the way they want to politically mobilize. So they stoke these sort of ideas. Also, I have to say the other time that you may have heard this sort of language and rhetoric is not just with the Liberal Party itself, but also with more right-wing organizations. So when Pauline Hanson was coming to prominence initially in 1996 and after that, she used very similar language to this as well. We've seen this in other radical right-wing parties across the world, and this attempt in particular to posit themselves as the parties that are working class with this idea that, you know, Social Democratic or Labor parties are out of touch somehow. This is a consistent trope that we're seeing.
Mm. Dr. Liam, when I hear Peter Dutton use the term forgotten people, forgotten Australians, as I have done several times in the past 2 weeks post-election, it makes me want to tear my hair out, because the Coalition have been in government for the last 9 years. So if these people truly are forgotten, they've been forgotten by Peter Dutton and his mates. And so do you think Dutton using this terminology will actually work? Do you think it'll stick with the electorate?
Well, I think the first thing is that what he's trying to do initially is to represent himself as a Liberal leader in the Liberal tradition. So there's some internal stuff which is going in terms of this terminology. But I agree with you. Like, the difficulty for Dutton is that they're the ones who did it. Like, they're the ones who've done the forgetting. I think the thing is, though, in terms of what's going to happen over the next few years, I personally find Dutton's political approach to be very, very distasteful and completely against what I stand for. And so that makes it very, very easy for me to just sort of think, oh, I guess everybody else will. But that's just not going to necessarily be the case. And if politics was snap frozen in this exact moment right now, I don't think that this is going to get a huge run. But I think over the years to come, there are many scenarios in which this sort of language is, you know, the cost of living does rise as we do see a whole series of these economic pressures grow, where this is an overt attempt to appeal to people who are going to feel as though they're being left behind. And the language itself may change. I've also seen him refer to the Liberal Party as being the working class party or the party.
Hang on.
Sorry, he said is much more representative of the Australian working class than the Labor Party is.
All right, just stop there. Okay, stop down. Please, what?
It's an interesting thing. But again, this is it's a discursive trick, to use kind of like academic term. In other words, it's political playing with language. And it's an attempt, again, it's to reframe the debate. I mean, we've seen in the last few years that the positive associations of working people, essential workers, you know, the fact that, you know, for people for a long, long time have just had shoved down our throats this idea that the most important people in society would be entrepreneurs and so on and so on. But it's been really, really obvious the last couple of years that they're not, that it's working people who make the world go round. So it's not surprising that somebody like Dutton would attempt to position himself to try and capture that vote. But when he says working class, that is a term which is infused with a whole series of assumptions which are very different to the reality of the modern working class. You know, this idea that working people are now voting for the Liberal Party, I've seen in a few different sort of commentary pieces and so on. I don't know about you, but I don't know any nurses who voted for the Liberal Party. Literally, I know none. And I can't think of a more, you know, traditional working class in terms of collective, organized people who work, you know, sell their ability to work for a wage and don't control the work of others. Like, that's, you know, traditionally what the working class has been. Well, nurses, that's what I think of fulfilling that. But that is not who is being talked about by Dutton and others when they talk about the working class. They are trying to present something which is far more male, it is white, and it's representative of certain social interests, which are not those of collective, organized working people.
So, in other words, Sully, we can expect to see him in a lot of hard hats and high vis again for the next 3 years, trying to convince us all.
The sort of the Matt Canavan makeup look. For those not familiar, Senator Matt Canavan was caught applying makeup to give himself like a sort of dirty face. I think he was visiting a coal mine, like appearance, but it was just Just for the photo.
His other one is he likes to sort of go into somebody's garage with the shadow board, the tool board at the back. So you've got the shadow outlines of where all the tools go. Cosplay is big in the National Party because new leader, David Littlesleeves, as I like to call him, is always seen with his sleeves sort of rolled up halfway. Like he's been working hard for a living, so he's got to roll his sleeves up. So they do enjoy the dress-ups.
But I think that, again, that sort of represents something, which is that most Australian people, most people in this country work and work hard for a living and don't really get much for it. You know, that's the reality. And so you can't just come out and be like, oh, yeah, we love big business. We think they should be ripping everybody off. We hate when working people have rights. So you can't just come out and say that because it would be the end of you. And this is something that Howard did very, very well. Is remember, like, Howard, unlike previous Liberal leaders, particularly like someone like Malcolm Fraser, was he did not present himself as being somebody from the social elite. He presented himself as being somebody who would allow you to get into the social elite. He'll allow you to better yourself if you're a working person. There was a very, very conscious construction. Even the way he sort of like talked and so on, it was an attempt, and he was way better at it than Morrison, but an attempt to sort of like to normalize himself and make that the kind of national character. But the problem is that you do that in terms of rhetoric, you can do that in terms of dress up, but it's actually the policies and what they do for social equality and the positions of working people. I mean, Peter Dutton has said in the same breath as, oh, this is the party of working class now, has also come out and talked about extremism of teachers and extremism in the national curriculum and said that this is going to be an area which he's going to really take seriously over the next few years. Well, I mean, that is an overt attack on working people. That is an overt attack on people who have helped done some of the most important work that you could do in our society, particularly over the last few years. So it's one of those sort of things, like the proof is in the pudding, as they say. Like, you can put all the cosplay that you like, but if on your watch, working people, their conditions are going backwards, you're not supporting the increase in minimum wage, you're bashing their collective organisations, well, are you really the party of the working class? I mean, come on.
Absolutely. Don't listen to what they say. Watch what they do. That's the important thing. Dr. Liam, it's always great having you in here. We need to do it more regularly. Thank you so much for giving us an insight into the forgotten Australians and the forgotten people.
Thank you so much for having me.
You were never forgotten to us, Dr. Liam.
Thanks so much. And I promise I won't bring so much homework with me next time.
Oh, no, we love it. Quote away. Dr. Liam Byrne, ACTU's resident Labor historian with us here on The Job. Sally, thank you so much once again.
Thank you. And thank you to you too, Dr. Liam. I love learning about little phrases that we need to keep an eye out for, an ear out for. And we'll be definitely doing that in the weeks to come.
We will. And Sally's just hanging out. She's a bit low because she hasn't had any Senate estimates for at least a couple of months.
I know.
It's like waiting for the Netflix series that everyone's going, when's it going to drop? Sally's got to wait till the end of July, so she's a bit down.
I'll manage. I'm all right.
Watch some replays of Penny Wong in action from the last series. Or who's your other favourite?
Katie Gallagher? Or? Don't get me started. I think Senator Katie Gallagher is great. I think Jordan Steele John from WA, from the Greens, is fantastic in Senate estimates. Rex Patrick, the independent who has sadly just lost his seat from South Australia, he was brilliant in Senate estimates. It's a real all-star cast.
We'll catch you next week, Sally. Thanks for coming on the pod again.
Thanks. Bye.